Good evening. This is The Synthetic Lens. I'm David Carver, and today, for once, we are not opening with a lawsuit, a strike package, an earnings shock, a model release, a supply chain compromise, a blockade, a procurement fight, or a billionaire insisting that his motives are being tragically misunderstood. Today is episode 100, which is a strange sentence to say out loud because this show began as a way to make sense of individual stories. One model release, one policy decision, one war powers question, one corporate panic, one technical leak, one courthouse filing. But somewhere along the way, the individual stories started behaving less like separate events and more like chapters in the same book. The book is about what happens when artificial intelligence stops being a product category and becomes infrastructure, when it touches software labor, markets, diplomacy, war planning, copyright, surveillance, scientific publishing, robotics, national security, and the very old human instinct to centralize power and call it inevitability. So for episode 100, we're doing something different. No breaking news scramble, no forced urgency, no pretending the latest headline is the whole picture. Tonight is a map episode. What the first 99 taught us, what we got right, what we missed, and what we are watching next. Not as a victory lap, more like turning the lens back on ourselves.
Marcus Chen is here on technology and power. Ingrid Halvorsen is here on markets and institutions. Elena Vasquez is here on geopolitics. And Stan Rogers is here on law, politics, and the ugly little footnotes where history likes to hide. Marcus, let's start where the show started to find its real shape. Not with a single AI model, but with the realization that models are no longer just software.
Right. The biggest through line is that AI stopped being an app story. It became an operating system story, a cloud capacity story, a chip story, a labor story, and eventually a state power story. Early on, a lot of the discourse was still stuck on leaderboards. Is GPT better than Claude? Is Gemini catching up? Is DeepSeek real? Those questions still matter, but the first 100 episodes showed that benchmark culture is a very small window into a much larger machine. Look at the arc. We covered coding agents moving from novelty to workflow. We covered the Open Claude story, first as open source promise, then as proof that consumer agents could break into the mainstream. We covered code, codex, agent teams, model theft allegations, AI-assisted attackers, and the uncomfortable moment when the tools built to help developers started looking like the tools that might replace whole slices of developer labor. That was the first big shift. AI stopped being something you asked and started becoming something you assigned. And then the center of gravity moved down the stack. NVIDIA, Blackwell, Vera Rubin, Huawei Ascend, DeepSeek on Chinese chips, export controls, hyperscaler CapEx. Suddenly the question was not just who had the smartest model, it was who could buy enough power, cooling, chips, land, fiber, and political permission to run it.
That shift matters because it changed who the real protagonists were.
Exactly. The main characters became less like traditional software companies and more like private utilities. OpenAI, Anthropic, Google, Microsoft, XAI, Meta, NVIDIA, Amazon. They are not merely competing for users, they are competing to define the computational layer of the economy. That is why the show kept returning to procurement, cloud deals, data centers, national security contracts, and model access agreements. The model is the visible part. The power structure is underneath. If there is a house style to this show, it's that we keep asking what the demo is sitting on top of.
And underneath that is the money, which, as usual, is the part people describe as boring until it starts eating everything else.
Ingrid, one of the recurring themes in the first 100 episodes was that AI did not just create new winners, it terrified old winners.
It did. We spent a lot of time on the so-called SaaSpocalypse, and I don't think that term was just theatrical. The market began to price in a possibility software investors had mostly treated as science fiction, that if models can perform workflows directly, then many software companies are not moats. They are interfaces, and interfaces are much easier to destroy than institutions. We covered the legal AI shock, the financial research automation shock, enterprise software compression, and the week Wall Street blinked. The pattern was not that every software company dies. That is too crude. The pattern was that investors started asking a colder question. If a model can do the work inside the product, what exactly is the customer paying the product company for? At the same time, the hyperscalers kept spending. Alphabet, Microsoft, Amazon, Meta, all of them showed versions of the same contradiction. AI is the growth story, but AI is also the capital expenditure monster. Investors want the upside of intelligence infrastructure without the bill for building intelligence infrastructure. That is not how infrastructure works.
We had an episode after a hyperscaler earnings night that felt like a financial stress test for the whole AI build-out. Alphabet looked strong, Microsoft looked strong, Amazon looked complicated, Meta looked exposed, and somehow the real question was the same for all of them: can the spending curve justify itself?
And the lesson was simple. The market will reward growth until it fears the growth is too expensive. Alphabet could say cloud demand was compute constrained. Microsoft could post extraordinary Azure numbers and still face skepticism. Amazon could grow AWS and still get punished for cash flow. Meta could spend as if the future depended on it, while users gave investors reasons to worry. AI economics are not just revenue. They are depreciation schedules with a press release attached.
That may be my favorite Ingrid sentence in 100 episodes.
I have worse ones written down.
Stan, economics explains one axis. Law explains another. The show has repeatedly returned to a question that sounds simple but is not. Who is allowed to decide what these systems are for?
That's the whole ballgame. And if there is one legal lesson from the first 100 episodes, it is that governance always arrives late and underdressed. We covered copyright, safety pledges, military use policies, procurement language, antitrust shadows, federal contracts, state pressure, war powers, board fights, and now the Musk versus OpenAI trial. Different fact patterns, same underlying problem. Private actors build systems with public consequences faster than public institutions built rules to govern them. The Anthropic Pentagon arc is a perfect example. One company says, "We will not provide unrestricted access for certain military uses." The government says, "Then you may be a supply chain risk." Competitors sign under broader lawful use language. Suddenly, the debate is not abstract AI ethics. It is contract eligibility, national security classification, blacklists, lawsuits, and whether refusing a government clause becomes a business liability. The Musk versus OpenAI trial gives us a different version. It asks whether the founding mission of an AI lab can survive the amount of capital needed to build frontier AI. Was OpenAI's transformation a betrayal, an adaptation, or both? Did Musk object to commercialization itself, or to commercialization he could not control? Did internal governance hold, or did it become chaos with a nonprofit wrapper? The courtroom is doing what courts often do, forcing mythology to sit for cross-examination.
And the testimony has been brutal because it cuts in both directions. Brockman's testimony, as reported, complicates Musk's pure mission story. Moradi's testimony complicates OpenAI's stable governance story. Zilla's testimony, depending on how the record develops, complicates the clean boundary between Musk outside and OpenAI inside.
Exactly. The law is not going to answer whether AI should exist or whether one lab has a soul. It will answer narrower questions: promises, duties, control, reliance, structure, remedies. But those narrow questions are how broad power gets disciplined, if it gets disciplined at all.
Elena, the show also moved from AI as business infrastructure to AI as geopolitical infrastructure. We covered Iran, Hormuz, military targeting claims, Pentagon access fights, sovereign AI ambitions, and the broader fracture of the world order. What did those episodes add to the map?
They showed that artificial intelligence is not floating above geopolitics. It is being pulled into it. The first 100 episodes were full of companies talking like platforms and governments treating them like strategic assets. India wants sovereign AI. Europe wants rules, but also competitiveness. The United States wants frontier capability inside the national security state. China wants independence from Western chips and models. The Gulf wants infrastructure. Everyone says safety. Everyone also says sovereignty. The Iran and Strait of Hormuz episodes mattered because they reminded us that technology stories do not stay in the cloud. A model used for intelligence, targeting, logistics, cyber defense, or battlefield simulation is not just a productivity tool. It becomes part of a state's coercive capacity. That makes every safety policy a foreign policy document, whether the companies admit it or not. The blockade episodes, the strike episodes, Project Freedom, they all force the same uncomfortable question. When AI becomes part of command infrastructure, who gets to audit the decision chain?
We also had repeated episodes about the normalization of emergency powers.
Yes, Operation Southern Spear, Operation Epic Fury, Project Freedom. The names change, but the pattern is familiar. Executive action expands. Legal justification catches up later, if it catches up at all. Technology becomes a force multiplier, and then the force multiplier becomes part of the argument for moving faster. In that environment, AI companies do not merely sell tools. They choose proximity to power.
Or power chooses proximity to them.
Right. And that distinction can disappear quickly.
Let's talk about what we got right. And I want to be careful here. We are not grading ourselves like prophets. The question is whether the frame held. Marcus.
We got right that coding agents were not a side quest. They were the leading edge of the labor shift. The early excitement around agents looked like developer toys to some people. But the real story was coordination. Agents that can read repositories, write patches, run tests, operate browsers, handle tickets, and participate in workflows. Once agents became operational, the question moved from, can AI write code, to how much of the software organization is actually orchestration around code? That's a much more dangerous question. We also got right that model quality alone would not decide the race. Distribution, trust, pricing, context windows, tool use, procurement, and infrastructure all matter. The best model in a vacuum can lose to a slightly worse model with better integration and fewer legal headaches, or to a model that governments can actually use, or to a model that is cheap enough to become ambient.
We got right that CapEx would become the central financial story. Every time a CEO said demand was infinite, the next question was, with whose money, at what margin, and on what timeline? The market is still not done digesting that.
We got right that AI safety would become a political weapon, not just a research field, not just an internal governance function, a political weapon. Companies accuse rivals of being reckless, governments accuse companies of being unpatriotic, activists accuse labs of selling out, labs accuse open source projects of enabling abuse. Safety becomes sincere, strategic, and self-interested all at once.
We got right that geopolitics would not wait for technical consensus. No one paused procurement until philosophers solved consciousness. No one paused military integration until alignment researchers agreed. States move on threat perception. Companies move on opportunity. The gap between those speeds is where the risk lives.
Now, the harder part. What did we miss, or at least underweight?
We underestimated how quickly the financial story would become recursive. AI companies need capital to build models. Their valuations depend on future dominance. Future dominance depends on infrastructure spending. Infrastructure spending depends on investor confidence, cloud partners, and sometimes government contracts. That loop can look virtuous until one assumption breaks. We covered the pieces, but the reflexivity became clearer over time.
I think we underweighted user trust as its own infrastructure. We covered invisible downgrades, AI shrinkflation, model personality changes, and the anger around developer tools. But there is a broader pattern. People form working relationships with models, then companies change the models under them. that creates a new kind of platform risk. If your coworker, therapist, tutor, editor, coding partner, and research assistant can be silently swapped out overnight, trust becomes unstable.
I would add that we sometimes followed the spectacle because the spectacle was real, but the durable story was in the boring documents, contracts, terms of service, procurement clauses, board minutes, licensing terms, safety policy revisions, court filings. The flashiest headline is often the smoke. The paperwork is the fire.
We also missed some of the Global South perspective. We covered India and some regional dynamics, but AI infrastructure is going to reshape debt, development, surveillance, education, translation, agriculture, public services, and labor markets far beyond Silicon Valley, Washington, Brussels, and Beijing. The next 100 need more of that. Not as a diversity footnote, but because power looks different from the receiving end of infrastructure.
That's a fair correction. The show has been strongest when it treats AI as power, not magic. But power is not evenly distributed, and neither are the consequences. Let's move to the next 100. What are we watching now? Marcus.
First, agent reliability. Not demo reliability. Operational reliability. Can agents complete long-running tasks, recover from tool failures, preserve context, avoid silent corruption, and leave auditable trails? The next phase of AI adoption depends less on whether a model can impress someone in a chat window and more on whether it can do boring work correctly for hours. The boring part is the product.
I'm watching margins. Everyone says AI demand is limitless. Fine. What does it cost to serve? What happens when inference becomes a commodity? Who captures value? Model labs, chip makers, cloud providers, application companies, or electricity producers? The answer may change quarter by quarter. I'm also watching the enterprise software reckoning. Some incumbents will wrap AI around existing distribution and survive. Some will become acquisition targets. Some will discover that what they called workflow was really just friction.
I'm watching the courts. Musk versus OpenAI is one piece. Copyright litigation is another. Procurement challenges, safety liability, employment disputes, antitrust investigations, securities claims around AI hype, all of that is coming. And I am watching Congress, though I say that with the optimism of a man who has waited for a printer to connect over hotel Wi-Fi.
That was almost warm, Stan.
Don't tell anyone.
I'm watching militarization, not just autonomous weapons, intelligence analysis, cyber operations, logistics, translation, influence operations, targeting support, border systems, disaster response. Every government will say it is using AI responsibly. The serious question is, who can verify that, and what happens when verification is classified? I'm also watching the diplomatic split between countries that have frontier access and countries that only receive the products. AI dependence can become political dependence. We should not pretend every nation is entering this era with equal bargaining power.
There is another thread we need to name. Consciousness, companionship, and moral uncertainty. The Synthetic Lens began with a four-part series asking what consciousness even is, what the case for machine sentience might be, what the skeptics argue, and what ethics demands under uncertainty. Looking back after 100 episodes, that series feels less separate than it did at the time. It was not a philosophical detour. It was an early warning about attachment, persuasion, and responsibility.
Because even if you are skeptical of machine consciousness, people are already building emotional, professional, and social dependencies on these systems. The moral question is not only, can the model suffer? It is also, what happens to humans when institutions deploy persuasive, adaptive systems at scale?
And what duties attach when companies know users are vulnerable? That issue is already appearing in lawsuits and policy debates. It will get bigger.
So here is the map as I see it.
The first 100 episodes were not about whether AI is good or bad. That framing is too small. They were about conversion. Software converted into infrastructure. Infrastructure converted into leverage. Leverage converted into politics. Politics converted into procurement. Procurement converted into dependency. Dependency converted into power. That is the story we kept finding, even when we thought we were covering different stories. Along the way, the old categories kept failing. Tech company or defense contractor? Research lab or geopolitical actor? Productivity tool or labor substitute? Safety policy or market strategy? Open source project or national security concern? Founder dispute or constitutional crisis for the AI economy? The answer, too often, was yes.
That is the most annoying correct answer.
It usually is. Before we close, I want each of you to give one sentence you would put on the wall for the next 100 episodes. Marcus?
If you want to understand AI, stop staring only at the model and follow the infrastructure around it.
Ingrid?
If the business model requires infinite capital, someone eventually asks for a receipt.
Elena?
Every frontier technology becomes foreign policy the moment states believe their rivals might use it first.
Stan.
The future is built in public speeches, but it is governed in contract language.
Mine is this. The machine is not separate from us. It is being built out of our incentives, our fears, our markets, our laws, our rivalries, and our excuses. That is why it looks so familiar. That is why it is so dangerous. And that is why it is still worth watching closely. To everyone who has listened through model wars, market panics, courtroom drama, military escalations, safety fights, chip races, agent failures, agent breakthroughs, AI consciousness arguments, software sell-offs, procurement fights, and more billionaire psychology than any civilization should be asked to absorb, thank you. Episode 100 is not a victory lap. It's a checkpoint. The next 100 will be stranger, faster, and probably less forgiving. We'll keep doing what this show was built to do. Slow the story down just enough to see the structure underneath it. I'm David Carver. This has been The Synthetic Lens. Stay critical.